Crispin Cross of Lead, Chapter 16 through 20. Chapter 16. Startled, I stopped. Then I became afraid. After what I had witnessed in the village, I could not believe I was hearing a living voice. But when the voice sang out again, and I realized it was coming from the abandoned church, I told myself that a church was an unlikely place for evil spirits to abide. Besides, food was uppermost in my thoughts, and I had desperate hopes that I might have come across a survivor. Trying to make no sound and clutching my cross of lead, I went around by the side of the church where windows had once been, but where only gaping holes remained. As I drew closer, the voice sang out again. This time, it was accompanied by the beating of what sounded like a drum. Ah, dear God, how can this be, that all things wear and waste away? Cautiously, I peeked inside. At first, all I saw was rubble and rot. Then, partly hidden in the shadows, I saw a man who was anything but a skeleton. On the contrary, he was a mountain of flesh, a great barrel of a fellow whose arms and legs were as thick as tree limbs, and with a tub-like belly before all. Legs extended, he was sitting on with his back propped against a crumbling baptismal font. He was, moreover, garbed like no man I had ever seen before. Upon his head was a hat, which seemed to have been split into two, like the points on a cock's comb. At the end of those points hung bells. Moreover, the flaps of his hat came down along both sides of his face, encircling it, then tied below, making his cheeks plump. Please stop here and consider question number one. As for his face, most striking was the bushy beard of such ruddy red it seemed as if the lower part of his face was aflame. He also had a large red and fleshy nose and hairy eyebrows of the same hue, as well as a cherry-lipped mouth big even for such a face as his. He wore a wide-sleeved tunic of black and ankle-length hose with a different color for each leg, one blue, the other red, though the colors were faded. His brown leather boots were long and somewhat pointy at the tips, yet for all this rare color, his clothing was ragged, torn, and patched in many parts enough so that I could see his dirty, hairy skin in several spots. A ballock dagger was fastened to his hip. On the ground by his side lay a fat sack which contained, I prayed, food. His eyes were closed, but clearly he was not asleep. Instead, he was singing recklessly while beating a small drum with his massive hands. As I looked on, he continued to tap the drum with his big fingers, bleating out his song. After repeating the words a few more times, he let loose a booming laugh as if he just heard a rare jest. He laughed so hard he put down his drum and opened his eyes. Compared to the rest of him, these eyes were small and wet. Old pig's eyes, I thought, shrewd and wily. But what he must have seen was me, staring at him, for he dropped his drum, and his hand went right to his dagger. Please stop here and consider question number two. We gazed at one another in silence. "Good morrow, lad," he cried out, even as his hand eased off his weapon. "May God keep you well."
God be with you too, sir, I managed to say, though I was in awe of such a monstrous man.
And where, by St. Sixtus, do you come from? He asked. Not, I suppose, from this godforsaken village.
I shook my head.
Then what place? He said.
Far away, I answered evasively.
East or west?
I pointed in the direction I had come from.
Scrutinizing me, head cocked to one side, he ruffled his beard while a sly smile played his lips. You have a gifted way of speech, he said. To what purpose do you travel?
I'm going to meet my father, I said, this being the answer I decided to give it fast.
And pray tell, does this father of yours live close?
In some large town.
He considered me for yet a while with his shrewd wet eyes. So, if I understand you, boy, he said at last, you know only somewhat from where you come. But go toward some other place?
As God is true, sir.
Do you have any idea how you look?
No, sir.
Your tunic is equal parts dirt, rags, and rents. Your face is scratched and mucked, as are your naked arms and legs. Your hair is long and unkempt. I can barely count your fingers for the caked filth. In short, you are more cur than boy. How old are you? He asks. And as God is merciful, don't be so vague.
13, about.
About, he returned with something like a sneer, plus another scratch of his beard. I said nothing, trying to make up my mind if I should run away, but
Still hoping that such a barrel of a man must have some food, I stayed. For his part, he continued to consider me steadily with his small, intense eyes. "Might you," he said as if reading my mind, "be hungry?" My mouth began to water. "Yes, sir, as God is kind and if it pleases you." "Hunger never pleases me," he roared. "This is our great, though our great if doddering king surely means well, his loyal subjects go hungry. And why? Because the officials of this most holy kingdom are all corrupt gluttons. His counselors and parliaments, all dressed in that new Italian velvet, sit upon the backs of the poor and eat their fill of venison and sweetmeats, not to mention the Flemish foreigners who loot our country's gold. But such is the will of his gracious majesty, that poor souls like you and I are not part of his daily reckoning. It is as it is his motto. Mine is, let—" "What think you of that sermon?" he said, cocking his head as if he really wished me to reply. "I didn't understand it," I said. "Not at all?" he asked, showing disappointment. "It sounds like treason," I said, only to instantly regret my words. Sure enough, his face clouded with anger. "Does it now?" he bellowed, making me jump. "So be it. I hate all tyranny. Is that treason too?" I did not dare to speak. Then, far softer, he said, "Well, by all the blessed saints and martyrs, what does it matter what I think? Come closer. I'll give you some bread." My hunger was so great that whatever prudence I might have had, I put aside. Instead, I returned my cross to my neck pouch and hurried around to the church's proper entry. I then approached the man where he sat, moving quickly when I saw he had untied the sack that lay by his side. With something close to elation, I saw him pull up a large gray lump of bread, which he held up. I reached out toward it. The moment I did, his free hand shot out, and with a speed that belied his bulk, he grabbed me by my wrist and held me with the strength of a stone. Please stop here and consider question number 3. Chapter 17. "Let me go," I cried, trying to pull back. "I only want my bread." "Bread is never free, boy," he roared. He was still upon the ground, but his arms were long and his huge hand held me fast while the bells of his hat tinkled with the force of his exertion. "Or is it treason to say that too?" No matter how I tried to pry away his fingers, I could not break his grip. "And what I'd guess," he went on, "is that you've run away from your lawful place. Out with it now, or by the wondrous music of St. Gregory, as sure as I beat my drum, I'll beat it out of you." "Please, sir, let me go," I screamed, for his hold was intense. "Boy," he bellowed, "I want the truth from you, or you'll suffer from it." His fingers tightened. "I told you, I'm going to a town." "For what purpose?" "To save myself." "Save yourself?" he laughed. "No man can do so on his own. No boy either. What makes you think you'll do it in a town?"
I was told."
"By what authority?"
"Father Quinnell."
"A priest?" he said mockingly, gripping me tighter. "I might have guessed. And you believed him?"
"Sir, you're hurting me."
"The devil takes your hurts. Why did you run away?"
I had to."
"Had to," he said. His grasp was so hard I thought my arm would snap.
I was pronounced a wolf's head."
"A wolf's head? That's extreme. For what reasons?"
"My master accused me of theft."
"What master?"
"The steward. I fear he'd take my life."
"And what did you steal?"
"Nothing."
"And yet you ran away."
"To save my life, sir."
"And failed to note that anyone who catches you may haul you back?"
"Please, sir, I'm in great pain."
"And what of the father whom you seek?"
"He's dead."
"Mother?"
"Dead too." I no sooner said that than he released me, but in the same motion he leapt up, swung about, and stood between me and the doorway of the ruined church. My way was blocked. Please stop here and consider question number 4.
Chapter 18.
Towering above me, hat bells tinkling with mocking laughter, bushy red beard like flames from hell, he seemed to me a true demon. "You have a new lord now," he declared.
"Please, sir," I begged, trembling with panic and rubbing my wrist where he had squeezed it. "I don't know your meaning."
"By the putrid bowels of Lucifer, boy, the law affirms that having unlawfully left your true master, you become servant to the first free man who finds and claims you. You've left yours, and I have found you, a gift from God. From now on, you'll serve me.
Please, sir, I said yet again, cringing. I don't want to.
You have no choice. You either do as I command or I'll march you back to where you came from. I'm sure I'll come upon your former manor soon enough. Once there, I'll toss you to the steward. No doubt he'll be pleased enough to slit your throat.
Please stop here and consider question number 5.
I don't know how you came, he went on, but did you perchance see that rotting man in the gallows at the crossroads?
Yes.
Did you read the screed that told of his crime?
I don't know my letters, sir.
Well, I do, and did. That man rose up against his lord and master. How? By holding back a pound of wool to sell that he might feed his sickly child. What he did was theft, the great man said, pointing down the road. And that's what they'll do to you for having done the same.
Have mercy, great sir, I pleaded, dropping to my knees in terror, for he seemed to know the awful truth of things.
Don't mercy me, he thundered on, leaning over me so that I felt no more than a tiny mouse. But swear, in blessed Jesus' name, not to leave my side, or else your blood will flow like water. And, as God is holy and good, I promise you, in such a cursed place as this, only the dead shall know. Do it! He shouted, now brandishing his dagger.
I was in such fright I could hardly breathe. Tears were coming hard.
I swear, I choked out. On the sacred name of Jesus.
On the sacred name of Jesus, I went on.
That I will be your servant.
That I will be your servant.
That if I default,
the words caught in my throat. It was a dreadful thing he was making me swear. One could never break such vows.
Say it, he cried, his dagger drawn closer.
In fear for my life, I said, if I default,
may the all-seeing God strike me dead where I stand.
May the all-seeing God strike me dead, I whispered.
Where I stand.
Where I stand.
Done, he proclaimed.
Then he put his dagger aside and tossed me a piece of bread.
Now you are mine, or God will chew you up and spit you out like the living filth all wolf's heads are.
Please stop here and consider question number 6.
Chapter 19.
Bread clutched in my trembling hand, I crept into the corner of the broken church, as far from the monstrous man as I could go. Though I swallowed the bread he had given me, I knew I sworn a sacred oath to which I was forever bound. Far better, I thought, to have died on the road. Hearing him move about, I stole an anxious glance in his direction. He had sat down again, but in such a place so as to prevent me from bolting. What's more, he was staring at me with his moist, sly eyes. I dared to look back with the greatest loathing I had ever felt.
Ah, boy, what does it matter? He said, speaking in a far softer voice than before. You didn't truly expect to live without a master, did you?
I made no reply. Or do you believe that someday none of us will have masters? Unable to find the words for my misery, I remained mute.
Answer me, he cried, making me jump. Do you believe that someday none of us will have masters or not?
I shook my head.
Why not?
God, I said, gulping down my misery, has willed it otherwise.
And yet, he said, leaning toward me and leering,
when Adam plowed the earth and Eve spun, who then was the gentleman?
His question was so unusual, I could not respond.
You don't like my sense of humor, he said. You think it treasonous. I wanted to say yes, but was too afraid.
You needn't be so resentful, he said. When you've lived as much as I, you'll learn to neither trust nor love any mortal. Then, the only one who can betray you is yourself.
I didn't know what to say.
Please stop here and consider question number 7.
Do you ever smile, boy? He demanded. If you can't laugh and smile, life is worthless. Do you hear me? He yelled. It's nothing.
I winced. Then, smiling, he cocked his head to one side and ruffled up his beard.
With a sweep of his hand, he snatched off his hat, revealing a bald pate. "By the love of St. Arnulf the King," he said, "you could do much worse than be bound to me." That stated, he seemed to pull back within himself and give way to private thoughts. Fearing what sudden thing he might do next, I watched him warily, but after a while he said only, "Do you wish to ask me anything? Who I am? My name? What I'm doing here?"
It doesn't matter," I stammered.
"Why?" he said.
"Because you're already my master forever."
"So be it," he said, acting as if I had offended him. For a while he toyed with his hat, not to any purpose that I could see, but as if lost in thought. At length, however, he reached over and took up his sack and rummaged through it. From it, he took out 3 balls, each made of stitched leather. To my surprise, he tossed the balls into the air. Instead of falling to the ground, they stayed in the air and rotated at his will, with only the smallest touch and encouragement of his fingers. I looked on, astonished.
"What do you think of that?" he said, laughing.
Are they enchanted, sir?" I whispered.
"Hardly," he said, as he continued to keep the balls in the air, sometimes higher, sometimes lower, until as abruptly as he'd begun, he gathered them in and they rested upon his great slab-like hands. "I'm a juggler," he said. When I made no response, he said, "Don't you know the word?" I shook my head. "A French word. It means I balance things, or toss balls, boxes, knives, anything I choose, through the air and catch them up again. And what do I do with my skills? I wander from town to town throughout the kingdom. Not as a beggar, mind you, but as a man of skills. Skills, boy, which enable me to gather enough farthings and pennies to live and keep this belly full." He patted himself on his large stomach. "Believe me," he said, "there's no place in the kingdom I've not been. Gascony, Brittany, Scotland too, for that matter. What think you of that?" He rushed at me with so many new and strange ideas I could not grasp them all. So all I said was, "I don't know, sir." Please stop here and consider question number 8. He cocked his head to one side. "Do you have any thoughts about anything?" I hung my head to avoid his eyes. He sighed. "What's your name?" I hesitated, not wanting him to call me what I had always been called, Asta's son, but I was not comfortable with my newly discovered name either. He leaned toward me, glaring. "Boy," he said, As I am your master, let me offer you advice. I am a simple man. I go by simple means. You'll do as you're told or suffer the consequences. Now, answer me, or as there is a loving God in heaven, I'll thrash you. What is your name?"
"I'm called Asta's son."
"Asta's son, that's not a name, it's a description. Were you never," he said, "christened with a name of your own?"
"I was told it was Crispin."
"Crispin, that's too fine and noble a name for such a rubbish as you. Have you a surname?"
"I don't know."
"Ugh, God's blood, you might as well have been a dog," he said.
It was all I could do to suppress screams of rage.
"Very well, Crispin, for henceforward, that's what I shall call you. I too am bound for cities and towns, but I wend my way to such places, not as a runaway peasant beggar like you, but earning my bread with tossing things into the air the way I showed you. People in towns pay fair coins to see my revels in squares, in merchant houses and inns as well as guild halls. Do you know how to make music?"
"Music?
By the devil's own spit," he said. "Have you lived your life under a rock? Were you born of sheep? Do you know nothing of drums, horns, and pipes? Do you even sing?"
"No, sir."
"God's holy wounds," he said. "Music is the tongue of souls. Is there anything you can do?"
"I can follow an ox, sow seed, weed, gather crops, thresh wheat and barley."
"Merciful heaven," he said. "And in this town or city you intend to go, were you going to plow the streets there?"
Unable to withhold myself, I cried out, "I don't know what I was going to do. I wanted to gain my liberty, and with God's help I would have, if not for you."
His eyes opened wide, then he tilted back his head and roared with laughter as if I had told the rarest jest of all. "Liberty," he said, "and with God's help too, I'll wager. It's a marvel you don't seek out the blessed St. Crispin himself to come to your aid. No wonder you want to die. The only difference between a dead fool and a live one is the dead one has a deeper grave."
It was as if all the scorn and insults I had ever endured were pouring forth from him. If there had been an open hole in the earth, I would have crawled into it willingly. "Ah, noble Crispin," he went on, "our blessed Lord in his wisdom must have sent you to me for instruction. I shall begin teaching you something. Mark me well, with all the armies of the kingdom at your side, you could not gain your liberty on your own. A boy, alone in the city, a wolf's head? Why, any city you enter would swallow you like the whale took Jonah, and not spit you out either, but only to belch up your empty soul." That said, he interrupted with another great laugh. "Now, go on. Let's see if you're capable of asking me a question." Struggling to find something, I said, What is your name, sir?" "Orson Hrothgar," he said, "but people call me Bear, because of my size and strength. Pay heed, young St. Crispin," he added, glaring at me with eyes that seemed to glint. "A bear has two natures, sweet and gentle. If he becomes irritated, he turns into a vicious brute. So I beg you to consider the two sides of my nature. Next question." "Where are you going?" I said. "To my death," he said, as must all men." "And before that?" I ventured. His eyes seemed to laugh. "Ah, you do have some wit. God's truth, before I reach my end, there's work to be done. Big work, the work of ages." "What is it?" He cocked his head and laughed. "On the feast of St. John the Baptist, I must meet a man in Great Wexley. Large things are brewing, young Crispin," he said grandly, "and I intend to play my part. Let it be as it may be, but time for that to come. Until then, you and I shall wander. Our task is to stay alive and measure this great kingdom with our feet, our eyes, our ears." With that, he tossed his sack to me. His meaning was perfectly clear. Huge as he was, I was to carry his belongings. Inwardly lamenting my fate, I lifted the sack and began my life as a servant to the bear. I began to wonder if he was mad. Please stop here and consider question number 9. Chapter 20. The lifeless village was soon behind us. Bear went first, moving over the road with the strides of a giant. And what a strange sight he was with his black tunic, legs of two colors, split hat bobbing, and bells jangling. As for me, with his heavy sack upon my back, I had to struggle to keep up. At first, we didn't speak. I was too down in my spirits. That I, in fleeing from one cruel master, should be bound to another was almost too much to endure, and to a man who claimed he hated tyranny. More than once, I considered dropping the sack and running away. I had to remind myself that I had sworn a sacred oath to stay. To break it would cast me straight away to hell. There was nothing to do but march along and do as God has willed. Then I recalled that Great Wexley was one of the places Father Quinnell had said I could gain my liberties. Perhaps there would be some advantage in my going there. Silently, I prayed it would be so. For the rest of the day, we tramped along. In all that time, we saw no one, nor came to another village. Once I asked, "Sir Bear, why are there no people about?" "By St. Roche, it's the pestilence," he said, confirming my fears. "Hardly any villages were spared in this area. But farther along, you'll see people aplenty. And in the cities?" "Is there no one left in them, sir?" I asked, worried that they too might have been abandoned. He laughed. "In London, say 30,000, 40,000. 40,000? I cried, astonished. "Don't worry, it's far more than any man, except the royal tax collectors, can count. And don't call me sir," he snarled. "Why?" "It's servile." "But you're my master." His answer was a growl. We had trudged on for I don't know how much longer when Bear stopped. "We'll take some rest here. Please stop here and consider question number 10.